listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Welcome to Full Power Living. We're the only show on international media dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm your host, Eileen Dillon. During this live broadcast, we invite you to interact with us on our chat here on the emotionalpro.com radio page, and you can also call in toll-free, 800-630-7858, 800-630-7858, and that number is also on the chat, and welcome to all of you who are already on the chat. So imagine living yourself an idyllic life that includes a successful business that has brought with it worldwide fame and money. You have a loving, supportive, communicative, spiritual, and wonderful partner you've been with happily for years, two beautiful children, and warm and involved family and friends. You and your partner are both in the prime of life. You're looking forward to years of togetherness, family enjoyment, romance, and partnership. And then one day, you kiss your partner goodbye as they go on another cross-country business trip, and you never see them again. Life as you know it and have expected it to continue has just ended. Your together life has suddenly become your alone life. This is what happened to Chris Carlson, our guest on Full Power Living today. So, what was next? The choices seemed to be either to fall apart and slide the slippery slope to getting lost, or to fall apart and get stronger. We're talking today about the choices that Chris Carlson made when her husband, psychologist Richard Carlson, author of Don't Sweat the Small Stuff and It's All About Small Stuff series, died suddenly and unexpectedly while on a business trip, leaving her to mourn him and then start her life over without him. She's done so well at this that she's written a memoir entitled Heartbroken Open, and she's here to share what she learned on her journey through loss to self-discovery. Chris Carlson can be found at Christine Carlson, KristineCarlson.com. She's the co-author of some national bestsellers in the Don't Sweat the Small Stuff series and the author of Don't Sweat the Small Stuff in Love. She's, or maybe it's for women. I'm going to have to ask you that, Chris, just a second. She has appeared on national radio and television broadcasts, including The Today Show, The View, and The Oprah Winfrey Show. She's also served on the board of directors of the Global Leadership Council for Challenge Day and helped to raise more than $600,000 for this nonprofit organization, which inspires children and adults to be the change they wish to see in the world. So, Christine Carlson, welcome to Full Power Living.
Oh, thank you so much, Eileen, for having me on. I'm very, very happy to be sharing with you today and having this conversation.
Great. Clarify for me, you're co-author of one and author of the other. Which is which?
Yeah, you know, Richard and I, you know, after Richard wrote Don't Sweat the Small Stuff and it became such a hit, he was one of the first branding authors. And so, he, you know, meaning that he had that one hit and then he was one of the first authors that started writing what he writes, more specifically targeted to the topics that his audience wanted to hear about. So we wrote a book in this series, the Don't Sweat the Small Stuff series, called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff in Love. And it was a book on relationship. And that was the one we wrote together. And then I wrote Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Women, while Richard wrote Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Men. And then after Richard passed, we really co-authored another book together, one that he had already written, which was a letter, An Hour to Live, An Hour to Love, a letter that he wrote to me on our 18th wedding anniversary 3 years before he passed, which I published back to him as a tribute to him and his authenticity.
Mm. Wow, that's a lot to be doing. It's only been three and a half years?
3.5 years, yeah. Well, you know, that book, you know, was one of the things that, for me, that was very empowering in the very beginning was, you know, it was such a shock for me to go from, you know, being in this just completely stable life to the unstable life that grief throws you into. And But one of the very empowering things for me was that I wanted to tribute Richard. I wanted to make sure that he had a national tribute. And so I had to, you know, I really waited for the divine to show me how that was going to show up. Like, I didn't know how I was going to do that. But then all of a sudden, one day in my grief, I really felt this just strong pull to find that letter that he had written to me. Because it was a 37-page letter. It wasn't any small letter. And so I wanted to find that letter as more to assuage my own grief. And I found it, and I realized how impactful this was and that this would be a tribute back to him, even though it was to me and our relationship and our love. It spoke everything that meant anything to him as a man, and it really showed the kind of man that he was. So it was so empowering to me, kind of like planting a tree would be in memorial. Richard also got some negative press after he died, because here he was, the stress management, one of the happiness experts of the world in stress management, and people, some of the reports said that he died of a heart attack, and he didn't die of a heart attack. He died of a pulmonary embolism, which is a very, very different scenario. It's actually a blood clot that releases from the leg on the descent of the flight. And they don't really know exactly what can cause this. It could happen to really almost anyone. And if you have one on the descent of a flight, it's lethal. So he did not die of a heart attack, and he died of heart failure from the pulmonary embolism. And so it just, you know, coming from our life, you know, it really angered me that, first of all, everyone dies. You know, it angered me that he was being criticized for how he died, and it wasn't even an accurate report. So I was very motivated to set the record straight. Mm-hmm. It empowered me in my grief to do this. And while it was very, very difficult, and I was very fragile while I did it, I didn't forge ahead. I really did it my way, and I pulled our agent out of retirement to represent me. I wanted to work with our house that we had worked with, the people that I was familiar with. I mean, I was very careful how I did this, but by the end, when it came out and it came to fruition, almost to the day of the anniversary of Richard's passing was the day, actually the first books were delivered on December 13th, which wasn't planned. They were delivered a month ahead of time because we had gotten on Oprah, and she had done this amazing tribute to him because of that book. And it was just really divine how it all worked out, I'll tell you that. It was just an amazing and an empowering, and it helped me so much in my grief process to know that I was doing this for him.
Mm-hmm. Our producer says there was a CNN reporter who suffered a pulmonary embolism sitting in a tank for too long in Iraq also. So, yes. That's
yes, there was. Yeah, David Bloom.
Bloom. Yeah, David Bloom.
Yeah, Bloom. Yeah, mm-hmm. he also, I know his wife, Melanie, she's like the spokesperson for the deep vein thrombosis, website and for their cause and stuff. And yeah, I mean, it's actually getting more common. I mean, I've known a few people that have passed from pulmonary embolisms that weren't even sick. You know, it's getting more common.
I know one person who actually survived it, but I don't think the embolism was thrown on the descent, but she did have a problem. I want you to tell us a little bit, set the stage a little bit. What was your life like? I know you met Richard when you were 18, but tell us a little bit about the background of your life with Richard. And I think because that sort of tells us why it was so powerful when he just, I mean, more than anything, why it was so powerful.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing about me and Richard was we had that fairy tale story, but it wasn't a story, it was actually real. You know, I was 18, he was 20, we met in college. It was love at first meeting, I mean, truly. Like, I knew from the moment after speaking with him for 2 to 3 hours, I was going to marry him, and It was like we always felt like we were home from the moment we met, and we had this incredibly compatible relationship. We had a super communicative relationship. We were best friends throughout our entire marriage. We supported each other through everything we did in life. We fought three times, and every time that we ever had an argument, which was what I would call a fight, it was because I had PMS. I mean, it wasn't because Richard did or said anything. It was just because I was off balance, you know, and it was, we had one of those amazing marriages. Like, it was rare. It was like a very rare marriage, and it was fun, and it was, you know, we had our trials. Like, we had our, in the last phase of his life, he was suffering physically from back pain, and, you know, he was suffering a great deal, but we had this very strong core value system in our marriage together, and it was like me and Richard, and then it was the kids. You know, our marriage came first, and then it was the kids, and so I think that what was unique is that we had this solid partnership that grew from the time we were very young kids to the time that we were middle-aged adults. That's rare that two people grow together so strong and so solidly, and that we stayed together and that we stayed in love. And so, not that, you know, our situation is unique, because everybody loses people that they love, you know, at some point in their life. You know, it's just that what was unique about our marriage was that the day that he walked out the door, I was as in love with him as the day I met him. So, and we were in such a very solid partnership. So it sent me, you know, while I was very used to being independent because our relationship was very healthy, you know, we both had a lot of independence in our relationship. You know, just missing that best friend, that partner, that lover, you know, all the things that, you know, we really completed each other on the male and female counterpart front. You know, there wasn't a competitive energy between us. If anything, Richard was always trying to push me up to stand directly beside him and not back in his shadow. He was that kind of man. He wasn't an arrogant man. He wasn't egotistical. He really was here to teach, you know, about how to be a happier and kinder and gentler person. He was here to teach the example that you live and love well, and that that's a fulfilling life in and of itself, you know, and he lived that, and, you know, I'm now living it now, you know, and I feel like my life now is really a testament to his work, because, you know, I was so richly exposed to everything that he taught, because I sort of learned alongside him, you know, as he was learning, I was learning, and we were spiritual seekers from very young time in our life, and I was really blessed to have all of those tools and to know, you know, at least as hard as grief is, I mean, that's kind of what inspired me to write Heartbroken Open, because I'd be laying on the floor just splayed like a fish, and I'd feel like I was going to die, and I would, all of a sudden, I'd think of, oh my God, how does the normal person who doesn't have the tools that I have, how do they do this process? It is just, it's absolutely a process that you survive sometimes. And then, lo and behold, as you go through the process, if you don't numb out to it and you actually embrace it, you know, embrace your grief, embrace, you know, embrace going through it, lo and behold, you come out the other side and you're actually more complete and whole than you were when you started, which is the miracle of it, I think.
Yes, and that is something that I think you really demonstrate and share over and over again in Heartbroken Open, how you stayed open to the process. It's very, very remarkable. And as a psychotherapist and a person who calls herself the emotional pro, I am so impressed with that, because I think we have very few models, everyday models, in the trenches models for being able to do that. And that's what you offer here.
Yeah, I tried so deeply to question myself every chapter, I pushed myself to the edge, like as far as exposure went. Like I just said,
yes.
You know what, this book needs to be a real, honest, impactful, raw, open, you know, why else would I write it? You know, I wanted to create like something real for widows in their 40s, you know, or people who are going through divorce in their 40s, something real, because this was my worst nightmare. I mean, I thought about this at times, like I would hear people they had to be dating in their 40s, and I think, oh my God, I'm so glad that's never going to be me. You know, and I mean, I would think of like, oh my God, I'm so glad that that'll never be me, you know, and and it's like, you know, I wanted this to be a journey of heart and soul, that if they really sit down and read mine, that they're going to realize theirs is the same thing, you know, that they're... Everything in their life has led them to where they are, and you know, and they have everything. Like, at least I felt that I suffered greatly. I mean, I loved this man with my heart and soul, and we gave each other our lives in life. You know, we devoted our lives to each other, and so that this grief, this, you know, this loss and grief is about love. It's about, you know, relinquishing what you cannot change, which is this incredible loss, you know. But on the other side of that, you know, I also realized I've been so blessed and gifted by having this great love that no matter what happens for the rest of my life now, I am not searching for something that I've already had, because I will always have that. I always have that, and it's in my heart and soul now.
Oh, that's so wonderful that it is. Yeah, I was thinking about those things that you just talked about. At one point in Heartbroken Open, you say that Richard often said that the circumstances of life don't make you, they reveal you.
Yeah.
And that's what you got revealed to yourself, but through Heartbroken Open, you're also revealing yourself to the world, which is really powerful, I think. So.
Oh, thank you. Well, I guess I feel like what we did in life was we exampled a lot of life for people, because all the chapters in the Don't Sweat series really came out of our lives. I mean, they really came out of, you know, Richard's observations of the things that were going on in our lives. And so I feel like as a continuation of what our purpose was together, and certainly it gives me great purpose to help other people and to serve. And, you know, I felt really, you know, divinely called to write Heartbroken Open. And I keep hearing the same thing from people, that they read it in 8 hours. They took it with them everywhere they went the day they started reading it, after they got through the first chapter. I know the first chapter was pretty rough for almost everyone, but they read it and they wanted to, you know, keep reading it, like, it, because I think it's so honest, and it's like people want something that's really honest and authentic, and I do. When I read something, it will not keep my attention if it's not honest and authentic. It just doesn't.
Mm-hmm. That's the way I experience it, too, though. I want to tell you, I dragged it out. I wanted it to last a little longer. You also talk in Heartbroken Open about how things prepare you for what's coming later, and talk about revealing. You reveal that you had an eating disorder, and you felt that prepared you or gave you some tools, certainly gave you the knowledge that you could go through something and get to the other side of it.
Absolutely. You know, it was funny because, you know, this book just really poured out of me, and it was such a healing journey. And I've never really come out publicly talked about my eating disorder before. But, you know, it just seems so appropriate because in my own healing, well, first of all, what revealed, the main thing that it revealed to me, which was very empowering, was that I'd had a full 100% recovery. And, you know, that's something that you live in question of when you've recovered from any addiction or any disorder. You know, you wonder, well, am I really recovered? You know, have I really fully let go of that habit, that thing? And it's like, you know, the last thing you want to do is open that door to have it come back and consume your life again, because I believe that people who go through addiction and recovery of addiction, they've stepped through the highest hoop of fire that there is, and they've walked into the fire. You have to be burned to the ground, and then you have to really adopt a whole new way of life. And certainly with food, that's the way it goes, because with food, you know, you can't just knock food out of your life. You have renegotiate your relationship to food. And also, it's such a deep relationship to the self. There's such a wounded self that, you know, that feels so out of control, that reverts to, you know, addiction, and especially in the eating disorder realm. And you know, so I really attributed, like, all this lifetime of love with Richard as really being the main healing force in my life. You know, that I had done a lot of work, and certainly by the time I met Richard, I was 85% recovered. But the tie-in with my grief was that I knew that I had been through tremendous darkness in my life. I knew that I had visited those dark places before. And, you know, I hadn't visited them in, you know, 20 years. But the beauty of what was uncovered for me is, no, I didn't revert to eating disorder again. So I realized I was fully recovered. Mm-hmm. The other thing that it did for me was that because I had visited that abyss before for a different reason, and maybe it was a form of grief, a spiritual grief that I was going through as a teenager. You know, I was a very sensitive, very deep-thinking, you know, girl. I wasn't like your average run-of-the-mill girl. I had all this deep sensitivity in me. And maybe it was a recovery from a spiritual disconnect, you know. But I equated this grief and what I would go through sometimes. I would realize, oh, my God, I've been to this place before. I know this place. I don't have to be terrified. I don't have to be scared. I've been through this darkness, and I've come out the other side. I'll go through this again, and I'll come out the other side.
Yeah, that really makes a difference. We're up to our first break now, and when we come back, I want to go more deeply into grief and some of the wisdom that you offer about grief, Chris.
Okay.
So you can find out more about Chris on the web at christinecarlson.com, KristineCarlson.com. And you're listening to Full Power Living. I'm Eileen Dillon, and we will be right back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
How difficult is it for you to ask directly for what you really want, to take responsibility graciously and willingly for your mistakes, or to relate with others because it's fun instead of because you need something from them? Most people believe manipulation and codependence are normal behaviors for adults. They may be common, but they're not normal. Manipulative behaviors really are designed to be part of childhood, to be put away as things of the past when we become adults. So, if you're ready to let manipulation and codependence be part of your past, then get the mini course I've created for you, Ending Codependence, The Bottom Line. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, offering you a formula that you can follow for creating healthy, manipulation-free, and lasting intimate relationships. I also give you the tools and principles that you can use to develop lasting immunity to codependence. Get Ending Codependence today at www.emotionalpro.com. That's emotionalpro.com. All right, we're back on Full Power Living, and I'd like to make a few announcements before we get into our topic of grief. First of all, you can download today's show on your computer or MP3 or 4 device. You can subscribe on iTunes under my name, Eileen Dillon, I-L-E-N-E-D-I-L-L-O-N, or you can download from emotionalpro.com website, where we have more than 300 archived Full Power Living shows here for you. We've been talking about emotions as part of every aspect of life for over 5 years now, and we've got all those programs waiting for you if you want to listen to them. Next week, we're hosting Sheila Singleton, who's author of Watchful Eyes, A Caregiver's Companion. Sheila invited her mentally ill younger sister to live with her, and it was an act that pushed Sheila into learning as much as she could about the caregiver's role. And she also ended up earning a master's degree in social work and helps other people as caregivers. As we're learning with Chris Carlson today, change can occur at any time, so get ready for the possibility of caregiving in your life next week at 9 a.m. Pacific time. And do look at the top of our radio page on emotionalpro.com for a fuller listing of upcoming guests. Also, we have two other radio programs that I co-host and create with life coach Dakey Fox on the Women's Information Network, the WIN Online, thewinonline.com. Those are entitled Emotionally Speaking and Building Conscious Families. So thank you for your loyalty and listening and telling your friends and family about Full Power Living and asking them to listen too. And thank you for being part of our mission, which is to awaken the world to the power and importance of human emotions. We're back now visiting with Christine Carlson, who's a fundraiser for Challenge Day and is author and co-author in the Don't Sweat the Small Stuff series. She's a mother and widow of psychologist Richard Carlson. So, Chris, before we took the break, I wanted to ask you about grief. You have a lot of interesting and important things to say about grief. For example, you say that grief is a journey. And as we were talking earlier, you stayed open to grief. You began to see it as an ally. And tell me more about what you learned about grief through this process.
Well, it was interesting because, I didn't have any real experience with grief before I was in it myself. However, and I also didn't do a lot of reading while I was in it. I don't know, there was something in me, Eileen, that just really, I knew in my heart that this had to be like a huge part of my growth cycle. Like, I knew in my heart that, like, deep within my belief system, there's no accidents in my life. And deep within my belief system, I choose everything at some level, maybe at the spirit level of some things, maybe at the divine level of what's going to happen in my life. And so taking this kind of responsibility for, I couldn't obviously take responsibility for Richard's death, but I could take responsibility for how I moved forward. And basically just to put all my tools to the test. I there were certain things that I knew that came to me. There was a mantra that Richard and I had embraced our entire lives together. We must have said this mantra, I don't know how many times through our meditations over the years, and just in different circumstances that we would find ourselves in with our family and just personally. But it was surrender, trust, accept, and receive. I added receive to it in my grief process. It was surrender, trust, and accept was the mantra we learned. And I added receive to it because what I realized is I just kept repeating this mantra to myself over and over again while I was in grief. And I mean, I'd be laying on the floor and in a contraction of grief. And grief does come in contractions. It comes in waves and contractions. And I would lay on the floor and my body would be all contracted and I would be saying to myself, Chris, you've got to surrender to this. You've got to open to this process. You have to allow this to open you. And I didn't really know what I was doing except that I knew that contraction was, contraction like in childbirth is there because it needs release and it needs an opening. And so I knew that. And so mm-hmm. I guess that's what led me into that mantra constantly, and it reminded me of childbirth. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm in labor. I'm mm-hmm. in labor. And the only other thing I thought is, oh my God, how long is this going to last?
About
like
as
I was
long
like,
as
oh
labor.
My God, this is not going to be 6 hours. This could be 6 years, I was like, that was a terrifying, that was always a terrifying thought for me because I am truly like such an innate person of joy. Like I gravitate toward joy. So, and light and just happiness. And I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to be happy again. I thought I'm never going to be happy again, but those were in my moments where I was, in deep despair. And then I would realize, no, just bring your attention back to the present. Stay in the now, which is where I would survive, and I was fine. Every moment, the beauty of that year for me was just, I practiced presence without even trying because that was the only place in alignment I could survive this. I would be in tremendous pain every time I thought of my past, and I would be in tremendous fear every time I thought of my future. So I just kept staying present. I just kept staying in the moment. And I think that's how I observe this process so intensely is I was so present to it, and I was so in grief when I was in grief, and I was so in my life when I was out. You know, I was just immersed in this present moment living, which was quite by accident. But I also realized how funny it was that Richard really, that was one of his key principles. Like Oprah even said, Richard Carlson taught me how to live presently, you know, and here I'm like, I'm in my deepest grief, missing him, longing for him, and he's teaching me how to live presently. I just thought that was hysterically funny at one point in my process.
Wow. Yeah. Well, now the surrender, trust, accept, and receive, that's a mantra for living all parts of life, not just
all
during grief.
Parts of life, in love, in loss, in life. I mean, that mantra is just, really, if you think about it, it's the basis of the Serenity Prayer. I mean, The Serenity Prayer is something like, God, grant me the serenity to change what I can and accept what I cannot change and the wisdom to know the difference. And, you know, surrender, trust, accept, and receive is very much a template like that. It's very much about surrendering, you know, thy will, my will to thy will, and about not resisting what is, being in alignment with what actually is. You know, all pain in life, I feel, comes from wishing things were different than they are. Now, that doesn't mean we don't wish things were different than they are, but if you really get that pain comes from that longing of wishing it was different, then it also means that you're not in acceptance of what is. And, You know, being in acceptance of what is it's really just a very, it's like a very Zen way to live. You know, it's a very peaceful, very self-loving. It doesn't mean you don't work hard. It doesn't mean that you don't have a plan. It just means that you have a lot of flexibility in life, that you have a lot of flexibility with your expectations, that you don't expect things to go a certain way. And when things don't go the way that you expect them, you are resilient. You know, you can be resilient to change, especially if you put that mantra, surrender, trust, and accept, and receive into motion. The receive part is that if you follow surrender, trust, and accept, then you receive the gifts of following that. And that's what I quickly realized every time I surrendered to grief, every time. The end of that grieving session brought me to this really peace inside, this warm, fuzzy feeling of tremendous love and grace and spirit. And I just was like, whoa, that's a miracle that something, you know, that you can open to this horrible experience, and as you open to it, actually releases, allows you to let go further and takes you into a deeper place of self-love.
That's really good. Last week, my guest was Karis Alexander, and we were talking about how so many people accept that being human is to suffer, and I have a hard time accepting that because, like you, I think that we suffer a lot because we are in resistance. And she pointed out that pain has a very important purpose. And as she was talking, I formulated that pain is the cosmic kick in the butt to get us to move and grow, which I'd never seen before.
Oh, totally. I completely got that. Like, I completely got that in my process that, you know, it's the elongated suffering that, you know, you're speaking of. The initial, like, people as human beings, yeah, you know what? Unfortunately, a human life is partly you are here to embrace all things, and human life isn't all a box of chocolates and cherries, and it's not a bed of roses. You know, we have our moments in life, and I think the key is to, you know, it's like what Richard taught people and everything that he taught is the key is not that you're not going to suffer, it's how do you suffer? How do you move through your pain? How do you embrace, you know, how do you do what you can but embrace what you cannot change, you know? And that's called grace, you know, that's called resiliency. And that's the human spirit that can get knocked down that gets back up and says, okay, I'm going to get knocked down, but I'm going to get up, you know, and that's the part that, you know, healthy tools, healthy living, you know, being in gratitude when things are really good, all of that plays a huge role in what happens to you when you go through suffering. And I maintain that there's really no great way to prepare for loss except in how you live day to day. It's like, how do you live your life day to day? You know, how do you sweat the small stuff day to day? Because if you do, and you let all the little things get to you from day to day when really something big happens, you know, you're going to fall apart more unless you're practicing, you know, healthy living day to day. You know, it's like, I feel like that's part of emotional fitness is just, you know, practicing a healthy life.
Mm-hmm. But you do make a point in Heartbroken Open that a person could develop, say, a spiritual practice or something that would offer somewhat, I guess I would call it like a foundation for handling things when the times get tough.
The people, and I don't know if you've seen this in your work, but I mean, in my own life, the people that I've seen that manage, you know, great tragedy, tremendous tragedy in their life, the people that manage it the best are the people that have done the work. You know, they're the people who've lived a lifetime of spiritual understanding. They get that life is not, that it's filled with lessons. They get that this lifetime that we have is a classroom, that it's about learning and growing and expression and experiencing joy. And it's also about embracing, you know, other things too, you know, and learning from those. And I think that for me, that was the cornerstone of my healing, was that I knew that. I knew that without a doubt. I didn't like it. I mean, I wasn't happy to be in this position. I thought it was incredibly unfair. I went through all of that, too. It's just that I knew in my soul that to fail this was to sit down and not do it. To fail this was to just try and numb out to it. To fail this was to fail Richard, and to fail our love was to let this knock me down and not get back up.
Wow, that's powerful. As the core of the work that I do as a psychotherapist is I offer people that the earth is a big giant school to which we all come in order to grow. And
yeah.
I laugh when you, and we get our homework assignments in our childhood usually, but I laugh when you know, because I just lost it. I forgot what I laughed about, Chris. Sorry about that.
Okay. It was something about schoolwork.
Oh, I know what it was. You were saying that you didn't necessarily like it. You know, people will look at me when I tell them how this is coming out in their life, and I'll just say, please, don't blame me. I didn't make it up. I'm just telling you how it works. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I don't think people, I think, you know, nobody wants to be told that anything happens for a reason, especially when they're in it. You know, like, I didn't want to be told that either, but deep down in my heart, I knew. I mean, deep down in my heart, I knew. I wasn't very proud of the fact that I needed this somehow. I was like, whoa, couldn't you have done this another way, Chris Carlson? You know, like, but I deep down in my heart and soul, I knew that I was being tested in the biggest way. And the only greater test for me would have been to lose my children, you know, that I knew, like, losing Richard was, like, it was like having my entire body cut in half. I mean, I felt him leave at the cellular level. I felt like when he first died and I found out, I felt like my entire body was on fire for weeks. Like, I just felt like he was being ripped from me. And it was horrible. It was horrible physical pain and emotional pain. I mean, like, I've never experienced anything like that. And it just, however, you know, I just, in my heart and soul, I just knew this is part of life. And just like giving birth, you know, we're geared to give birth. I mean, you can't find too many women who are laying on that, you know, on that gurney with their legs splayed open in those stirrups saying, oh, I'm so glad I'm here right now. Like, you know, you're pushing that baby out, and what you really, you're putting your whole being is in that process of pushing those final pushes of that baby out. And that's very much like what grief is like sometimes. It's like you don't, you're geared for it. You don't want it. Nobody wants it, but you're geared for it. And to do the work is to push the baby out. To do the work is to heal and to heal completely and to move forward in your life empowered and to move forward knowing that you're ready to embrace a new life. And, right. you know, that's not something I ever wanted, but that's something I got.
But just like in childbirth, it's like the childbirth is part of the process.
Yes.
That's just it. That's just what you have to do. So going through things on the earth is part of the process of being here.
Right. And Richard, I love what he used to say. I love this quote of his. It's like life is a process, not a destination. You know, mm-hmm. that we are here to process life, that it isn't a destination. Many times you see athletes or anyone in life, they have this goal. And what part of it do they always say was the best part? It was getting to the goal. Like you look at Olympic athletes and they get their gold medal and they're like, okay, now what? You know, it's like all that work and that process. And it's like, that's the part that's life. That's when you're alive, you know, reaching the goals, reaching all of that. That's just the little icing on the cake for a little moment. You know, it's not what it's all about. You know, it's life is a big experience, and how you come about it, how you look at it, you know, any way you slice it, it's a big experience for all of us. We all have a story. We all have many stories within our story, you know, and it's just really, you don't have a choice oftentimes in what happens to you, but you have a choice in how you manage it and how you move forward in it.
Absolutely. We're up to our second break. We're talking today with Christine Carlson, author of a book entitled Heartbroken Open. You're listening to Full Power Living, and we'll be right back.
Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Everybody feels anger, but if you don't learn to deal with it, anger can mess up your life. It can cause you relationship problems, difficulties on the job, or create health problems. If you want a way to understand and work with anger that's simple yet so powerful, it helps you to put an end to the specific angers that are messing up your life, then you'll want to get a copy of a mini course I've created for you entitled Reduce Anger Now. With it, I want you to be able to figure out what's stimulating the anger you feel and have an easy way to change that anger so you can dramatically reduce the anger in your life. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, longtime psychotherapist, coach, and anger expert. I've helped thousands of people to master anger, and I want you to begin to become an anger master in your life. Order Reduce Anger Now at the store, www.emotionalpro.com. That's www.emotionalpro.com. All right, we're back on Full Power Living with Chris Carlson, author of Heartbroken Open, a memoir through loss to self-discovery. And Chris, since we just listened to that ad about anger, let's talk about some of the emotions that are involved with grief. You've mentioned pain and fear and anger. And one of the things that clearly you did was stay open to your emotions. And you weren't always in your life that fully open to emotions.
No. I think my natural tendency actually is much toward repression. You know, my natural tendency is really not to do that, you know, which was one of the most amazing things to me in grief was I wasn't suppressed at all. And it was truly like... you know, it was a beautiful experience for me. I mean, I felt like I was, you know, when I would cry like these rivers of tears. And I hadn't cried probably like 10 years before that. I mean, you know, so it was like I always had a really hard time, like, just sitting and having a good cry. Even though there were days as happy as I might have thought I was or was, or, you know, as great as my life would have been or was, I still thought, God, you know, I really need to have just a good cry. And I couldn't make myself cry before Richard died. I mean, it was like, I just couldn't do it. And, you know, one of the beautiful openings for me was just this incredible permission to just express how I felt. And, you know, I literally would just sit quietly and allow my body to lead me where I needed to go. A lot of times for me, it started in my stomach. Like, my stomach would just get this really tight knot, and I wouldn't know what was going to come. And then I'd just sit on my floor, and I would just scream, you know. I'd just scream, and I would be, like, kicking and just hitting the pillows and, you know, just kicking and shaking and, you know, and sometimes I would just laugh hysterically. I would laugh till I cry, or my body would just start to vibrate and shake, and then I would start to cry, or I would, you know, I just acknowledged all of it. Like, I would just acknowledge my feelings. I was very unfiltered, very uncensored. In fact, you know, I there was a time where I realized, I'm like, okay, it's time to rein it in. Like, you know, I mean, there was a time when I started emerging back into life where I realized, you know, maybe I need to be a little more sensitive about other people's feelings again. You know, like, you know, I had to kind of coach myself back into life, you know, where I was more palatable to people, you know, more, because it was like I was so unfiltered and I was just so raw, you know, just really in such a raw place. But the beauty of that is that I feel like I really moved through what was in front of me, and I still do. You know, sometimes I get, you know, my grief is triggered, you know, and it's, I know what it is. It's just, it's my grief being triggered, and I just know that it's time for me to just, you know, let myself have a really good cry and a really, you know, feel sorry for myself moment, you know, because as great as my life is, it's not easy being without my partner. It's not easy stepping into his world and taking over everything he had to do and still do everything I did. I'm still a mother. I'm now a grandmother. I'm all these things, and I don't have him, you know. So I feel sorry for myself about that for a minute or two, and I just say, okay, it's okay. You can feel sorry for yourself. Now dust yourself back off and get back into it.
Good. Wow. You're really open to that. One of the things I learned years ago is that the four things that occur when we heal are laughing, crying, sweating, and shaking.
Yeah. So, Isn't that interesting? Yeah, that's interesting, because I didn't know that, but those definitely are all things
that you did.
My body just did naturally, you know, that I didn't try to do them, and I'd never done them before, but I just naturally did those, like, that they just felt that, you know, that was what was healing me. And mm-hmm. You get this reward. The way I knew was I'd have these reward feelings afterwards. Like, my body would thank me because the tension would be gone. My stomach would no longer hurt. I actually felt peaceful inside. And sometimes I even felt in bliss. I mean, sometimes I felt so connected to Richard and so in bliss through this process. But that was a big surprise, too, that this grief and that Richard's death had breathed new life into me. And mm-hmm. That's like amazing. That's a miracle.
Well, it's also the way that you chose to go through it, I think, that really allowed that you to do that. I want to ask you, because I love the chapter that you wrote about all the ways that people attempted to help you through your grief that didn't work and how you reacted to them. So I want to just ask you to give one or two things that people do to supposedly help people with grief, and
Well, oh my gosh, that is probably a favorite chapter for most people. It was my least favorite chapter to write because it still annoyed me as I wrote it. And even when I read it at a book signing or something, I still get annoyed when I read it. But, you know, there's a way in which our culture is very uncomfortable with grief. And I want to acknowledge that it's a difficult situation. You don't know what to say. You want to acknowledge the person that's going through loss. You know that their situation, it could be your situation. You feel tremendous, you know, you feel sorry for them. You feel their pain in a sense. But the thing for me and what I realized too is where somebody is in their deep grief process is not where they end up. And the things that you could say to them at the end of it are not the things that you can always say while they're going through it. So I guess what I really want to encourage people to do is to be extremely sensitive to the fact that you really don't know where that person is on that given day. And therefore, what you say may not be the right thing to say just simply because they're not in that place. And so what really resonated the best with me was not what people would say, but what they would do. And when people looked in my eyes and told me, you know, I just want you to know I'm praying for you. I want you to know I think of you every day. I want you to know I don't have words for what you're going through. I don't have words. That was the most comforting thing that somebody could say to me. That when somebody said things like, well, you know he's in a better place, or, you know, Chris, you should be really grateful that you had that amazing relationship. Well, you know, I freaking wasn't grateful in those moments. I wasn't grateful that I had that relationship because I didn't have it anymore, you know, right. And I was going through my process. So am I grateful now? Absolutely. Am I in a totally different place now? Yes, I'm on solid ground. When you're like in grief, you're like falling every second, you know, and people don't know that. They don't know that this person may be appearing to be standing before them, but they're not. They're falling into a hole every single moment as they're going through this process of loss. And it's really just to offer a container of support to show somebody through your words, through your acts of kindness, that you're there to support them. You're not there to fix them. You're not there to make them feel better. There's nothing that you can do to make them feel better. You can only support them. The only way that they're going to feel better is to go through their process of loss, peel it off like an onion. It's going to take who knows how long. For each person, it's very different. But, you know, I really feel strongly about that, you know, that people should really offer themselves in that really strong line of support, but not in their words and their wisdom. It's not the time for that.
Right. You know, certainly the grief I felt was not nearly what you were going through. But a few weeks ago, my 2-year-old granddaughter was injured and had to be airlifted out of the family vacation spot. She's better now. She's healing. But, you know, it was like a day afterwards, and I turned to my husband and I said to him, I may look normal, I may sound normal, but I need to advise you that I am not normal inside.
That's smart.
You know, and I'm thinking if you have the presence of mind or you can do that, it might be helpful to the people around you. It certainly allowed us to do well. I learned this when my sister died, and my husband was treating me as if I was functioning normally, and she died right here in our home after a long bout with cancer, and I realized he thought I was just normal, and I wasn't, you know, because it wasn't showing on the outside at that moment, you know.
That's a really good piece of advice, but it also is a difficult one for people who are in grief, because it's like you don't want them to have to take care of anyone else during that time, you know. Like,
yeah.
I don't think people should expect, you know, I think it's their time, you know. It's time for you to rally to support somebody that's in grief, like not time for you to. I have friends that expected me, like I had one girlfriend who called me up 6 months in, and she was actually upset with me about something about, you know, oh, you invited so-and-so and you didn't invite me, and that wasn't very, you know, I took that, and she was crying, and I remember thinking, you know, what the hell here? I mean, really, like, what are you talking about? Like, how could you even be that self-absorbed that you would be thinking about yourself, like, or that I'm thinking about who I'm inviting? Because it's like, I'm surviving, you know, I'm like, I'm going through the motions of these things for my kids because I have to. I mean, it's like, I'm, you know, and this is really important in a support role, like to know that that person isn't capable of taking care of anything more than they have to. They
right.
take care of themselves, they take care of their children, they take care of the details that are in front of their life, but they are not capable. This is not, they are healing, they are broken. They are not the person that you knew. They may emerge back to that person, but that's going to take time. And as loving, compassionate people, and that you really want to offer, you know, some support, then that's what you give them. You give them that time to be selfish. You give them that time to not take care of you, to not be the friend that you knew and loved. You know, that this is their time. This is their time to heal.
Mm-hmm. That's really, really great. And I certainly agree with your point. Part of my motivation is to alert people, too.
Of course.
Yeah,
and that's always the best. No, that's an incredible piece of advice and mm-hmm. just incredible. Mm-hmm. Like, it's always the best way is to communicate where you are, for sure. There's no doubt.
Yes, but when you're in terrible grief, you're not busy communicating, and I think you're totally right, and that was something I really liked that you expressed in Heartbroken Open, that you let yourself just be who you were and not try to take care of anybody and not really care about what was going on with anybody else right then, and clearly it was the thing that you needed to do in order to get all the way through.
Yeah, and I'm through now, and now I care again, you know, and that's the thing, you know, you don't stay in the same place that you were, you know, it's a temporary situation like all things, you know, and like I said, I've had a couple of really serious talks with myself, you know, I noticed how, whoa, I could, like, I've become pretty narcissistic, you know, like, whoa, I need to rein it in now, there's been widows that have shown up in my life, and I'm like, I remember the first time it happened, it was like a year and a half ago, and I remember saying to myself, it's your turn now. It's your turn. You know, shake it. You know, this mm-hmm. is going to trigger your own grief, but it's not about you right now. It's about her. It's about supporting her through this initial, you know, horribly shocking phase of mm-hmm. where she's at. And mm-hmm. you know, and that's the beauty, is that people do come back. They do. And you just have to trust that, you know, that they're going to, and hold that space for them, too.
That's great. Well, you have so much wisdom. You know, two or three weeks ago, we had Marilyn Schlitz, who's the president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. She was talking about her book, Living Deeply. She was our guest.
Oh, wow.
And when I read Heartbroken Open, I realized it's all about living deeply on a very personal level and very genuinely presented. And
thank you.
So I think it's a fantastic revelation, and I hope everybody who wants to be inspired and touched will read Heartbroken Open. And I have to draw this show to a close now, but I really want to thank you for sharing your story and also for being with us here on Full Power Living today.
Oh, Eileen, you have such a great show, and it offers such incredible tools for people. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, Chris. I hope we'll be able to have you again with the next Don't Sweat the Small Stuff book or something, whatever you're doing next.
Oh, yeah, there'll be another book. I don't think it's going to be a Don't Sweat the Small Stuff book, but it'll definitely be where I'm at now. It'll probably be a reinvention revelation book. It could be about dating. I don't know.
Your own brand. That's what it's going to be. Your brand this time.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you. So we look forward to having you with us again next week when Sheila Singleton, author of Watchful Eyes, A Caregiver's Companion, will be our guest. And I want to thank our producer, Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media, for his longtime support and care of us here at Full Power Living. And for now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention to what you want to become, not to what you want to overcome.
to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.